podcast covers a variety of true crime, mystery, and unexpected stories. A warning that episodes will contain graphic details and may not be suitable for everyone. Welcome back to Death and Taxes. Thank you for being so patient with us, guys. We've had gastro, well, I certainly have, and I didn't lose any weight, outrageous, and school holidays. So we've been on a bit of hiatus, but we are back and ready as ever. So I'm Carrie.
And I'm Benny.
And we have a special surprise guest for you tonight. So unfortunately, Lizzie is moving across country. We wish you well, Lizzie. So she'll be taking some time off. But we've got lovely Claire, who has guested for us in the past, and she's going to be presenting a case this time. So we're really mixing it up. Welcome back, Claire.
Hi, everybody. I'm very excited to be here. Thanks for having me back.
Welcome back. So for those who don't remember, Claire was here for our World Records episode. She was a guest host there and did a terrific job. And I remember at the end of that episode, we asked, would you ever come back and present a case? And you said, absolutely. So here we are. We're thrilled to have you.
I have been waiting for this moment. I've been preparing for this moment. And I have to say, I was absolutely thrilled when you asked me to be back. So very happy to be here.
So we don't know what your case is either. So we're both very interested to know what you've chosen.
So the case that I've picked today is whenever I think about what case I always come back to, and the case that whenever I'm speaking to fellow true crime interesters, it's the one that I always suggest for people to really deep dive in, and one that I just still have so many questions about. And it is about the brutal and very tragic murders of the Pelly family in 1989. So this is a pretty heavy story, so I do want to place a trigger warning here, as we will be discussing the unaliving of children. So this story has many moving parts, some secret past lives, heartbreaking potential assumptions made by police who really were just desperate to find some peace for the Pelly family, and the conviction of a man who many still have a lot of questions about. Was he actually responsible for the murders, or was he an obvious choice that the police chose to narrow in on?
I don't know this one. I'm excited. No, that's the wrong word to use. Cut that.
Do you know this one, Ben?
I don't know it either, but I remember you mentioned it in the World Record episode. I think we said, like, what's your favourite crime at the moment, or what are you most fascinated with? And you mentioned the Pelly family, and I actually haven't looked it up since then. I think you mentioned the Counter Clock podcast or something covered it really well or something.
And yeah, absolutely.
I'm glad I didn't listen to it, because now it'll be fresh for me.
Yeah, absolutely. And I will give a plug to Counterclock quite a few times in this episode as well, because their very deep dive investigation about this case has a lot of fascinating details that, if people do enjoy this episode, I highly recommend they go and really deep dive and immerse into this, into their, I think it's about 20 part series on this case. So, but don't worry, I have summarized as much as I can for our episode today.
Look at her trying to weasel her way in for 20 episodes already. She's like, this will be a 20 parter.
Yeah, this is part one, everyone. Stay tuned for next week. So before we talk about the crime itself, I do just want to take a beat so that we can actually get to know the large blended Pelly family a little bit better. I think it's always really important when we're talking about these things. It can be really easy to kind of get caught up in the crime itself, that it's actually human beings at the end of the day. And particularly with this case, because there are a lot of questions, I want to give weight to everybody that's involved. So I want to introduce you to Bob Pelly. He and his sweetheart Joy and their two children, Jeff and Jackie, lived in Fort Myers in Florida, where Bob held a pretty good job working for the Landmark National Bank, which allowed the Pellys to live a pretty comfortable life. The Pelly family were also heavily involved in their local church community. They formed really close relationships with their local pastor and fellow worshippers, and were a constant at the services. So every week they were involved a lot with the church. So from here, in February in 1985, sadly Joy passed away from a very tough battle with cancer. This was a really big, devastating, and I guess like a really big pivotal moment in their lives, because it did put Bob squarely as the parent from here on in. And from everything that I can everything that I've read, Joy was a very hands-on mum. So this loss was really big for Jeff and Jackie, and the transition to having the parenting style of Bob was something that was quite formative in these years. So at this time, Jeff and Jackie are sort of young teens at this point in time. So to connect our story a little bit more, not too far away in another town, Dawn Huber, a mother of three young girls, three more J names, Jessica, Janelle, and Jolene, was also dealing with tragedy following the unexpected and accidental death of her husband, Edward John Huber. And so according to reports, he was working on his car in his garage. It was a really cold day and he had the door down. He was having a couple of beers working on his car.
Oh, no.
And yeah, accidental carbon monoxide poisoning was the official cause of death. And he was very young, like sort of early 20s or mid 20s. So massive loss for this very young family. They were also a very religious family as well. So again, another huge transition for Dawn to now become single mum with three very young girls. The girls were very, very young at this point in time. But as fate would have it, it would actually bring Bob and Dawn together through a mutual friend. So a mutual friend that knew Dawn also knew Bob. They met a few times. Actually, the kids had met Dawn before. So Jeff and Jackie had actually met Dawn before, in just like one of those weird, the world is small types of scenarios. But when Bob and Dawn met, they hit it off immediately, really both leaning into that passion for religion.
I thought they were going to have met on like a We Love J Names like Facebook group. Or like a widow support group. I was like, oh, they're going to go to the widow support group at church. Bless them.
I think there's probably an element, and I'm probably just making assumptions here, but both being single parents and having kids and being religious, I think that draw for family was probably a big kind of contributor to like how quickly they moved with each other. So they really didn't waste any time, and they were married by November 1985. So just a reminder, Joy passed away in February of that year. So it was very quick turnaround.
That's a little suspicious. Did you say they had met her before?
Oh, no. So like the kids had met her before, but Bob and her didn't form a relationship until after, but they certainly didn't waste any time. So yeah, so didn't waste any time, and they're married by November 1985. So not long after they got married, Bob also went to his pastor and he said that he had had a calling to the church and had decided to leave his job at the bank and take up the role of reverend in Lakeville, Indiana. So states away. And from what the pastor has said about this was that it was quite unexpected. While Bob had been very passionate about the church, he actually didn't have experience for this kind of role and had never done this type of thing before or sought guidance to kind of take this path. So it was quite unexpected and quite sudden. They kind of made the decision and they left pretty quickly from everything.
Do we think that's like a grief thing? Like grief makes you do the wacky, it makes you do weird
stuff.
And people search for meaning and think, people get a bit more spiritual after these things. I think that makes sense. I can see it.
Very true. And I guess also because Bob and Dawn are both religious, the loss and the grief of, you know, maybe God's brought them together and brought their family together. So give something back to the church. I didn't find anything that kind of indicated that, but that could definitely be something that kind of brought them together for that. So in early 1986, the blended Pelly family set off to Lakeville, Indiana, and set up home at the house next to the church. So this is a pretty small town, and so it's, I think, a church that's got roughly the patrons of about 50. There's about 50 that come kind of quite regularly. And the little house that they lived on, basically on the same kind of block, if you will, is called a parsonage a lot. So it's a very, very small house for five kids, but they set up house in there. They all joined school. Dawn was very involved in the Girl Scouts, so she kept going, kept her work up as a Girl Scout leader. And Bob found that happiness that he was trying to seek as a reverend, really beloved by the town. And by all accounts, he was very active in the community. So not just in the church, but would often go and see people and spend time with people across the town. So he was, the Pelle family were quite well known in the town. It was a pretty small town.
It sounds very small. Like if his congregation's like 50 people, I'm assuming it's a very tight-knit small community. Like everyone probably knows everyone. Yeah, I can see himself getting embedded in it.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's kind of conflicting opinions, I guess I'm going to call them opinions, on whether the blended family were completely happy and all about this kind of coming together for each other. The surviving children have commented, I guess, on both sides of the fence of that. So a few of them have said that they were happy about the marriage, not a problem, but there was some tension about, I guess, different parenting styles and the expectation perhaps to call their now step-parent mum or dad. There was kind of that friction point. It's also worth noting here, though, that so Dawn's three girls, so Jessica, Janelle and Jolene, are very, very young. They're kind of at this point in time, I think Jolene's about three. So they're very, very young girls, whereas Jeff and Jackie are sort of mid-teens at this point, or like early preteen maybe is probably a better descriptor there.
It's going to be a lot harder to, like, take on a new parent when you're a teen. If you're three, you know.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And we know from The Staircase, different kids, you know, you can grow up in the same house, you can have the same parents, you can have, it's totally different, experiences, yeah.
That's a very good point. And also, I guess, different perceptions of things that happen as well, like in your family, especially when you're kind of, like, reflecting on it as an adult or somebody older and kind of putting that adult lens over some of the things that might have happened or events that might have occurred and your interpretation of things that maybe you didn't frame it that way at the time that you do now. I always kind of think about those types of things in these types of situations as well. So just a reminder, they moved to Lakeville in 1986. So this now brings us to Sunday, the 30th of April, 1989. The local parish is beginning to congregate at the church, eager to commence their regular service. However, Bob Pelle is nowhere to be found. From many people's accounts, this was extremely unusual behaviour for Bob, who was always first at the church, always warmly welcoming the close-knit community. And also unusually nowhere to be found was Dawn and the children. So by all accounts, they were sort of first there, actively out and about, and because they lived right next door to the church as well, you could see them, kind of thing. Yeah. So after waiting a little bit of time, Dave Hathaway, a member of the church, and several others went over to the parsonage to check on the Pellies. But there was no answer. And what was very noticeable at this point was the silence. So if we put the age bracket of particularly the three young girls, like they're, you know, kids allowed, like Carrie, adore your girls, but those girls are loud. Yeah. And so, so silence in a house is extremely alarming straight away.
And getting them all through breakfast, you're getting them into their church gear, like their Sunday best. Like, it would be absolutely chaos in a house like that, I imagine, in a small house like that.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of the church members also noted that the girls were often seen playing in the yard with their dog before church. And when they got to the house was completely closed up. So all the doors were locked, all the curtains were drawn, which is extremely unusual behaviour for the family.
Was the dog there or barking?
So the dog, so it had like one of those like night tracks, you know, like so kind of like a caged in area where it would be. So where the dog, so yes, the dog was there and was in the yard, but the, I guess the routine that the family had and the dog being let out to play, that wasn't there. So straight away, it kind of indicated that nothing had happened in the morning. That's probably the best way to frame that, I think. So they proceed to check all the doors. They knock continuously, no answer. So they go back to the church and get the spare key. I think somebody ended up having to drive and go and get the key, but they did have a spare key to the house. So David takes the lead on here and he goes into the house. And as he's moving through, he starts, remember it's a very small house, but he starts moving through the house and towards the back of end of the house near a bedroom in the hallway, he finds the body of Bob, deceased, who had been shot multiple times at close range with a 20-gauge shotgun. So just referencing that 20-gauge is quite big. So the crime scene was pretty horrific and by all accounts, anybody that had been there when they recount this scene talk about the trauma and the severity of what they saw. So panicked, he called for the other people to come in, assist him, call 911, and they start to move through the house. At this time, they move down to the basement where they sadly find the bodies of Dawn and the two youngest Pelly girls, Janelle, who was only 8 at the time, and Jolene, who was only 6. All shot at close range with a 20-gauge shotgun.
Oof, brutal.
Yeah, super brutal. Mm-hmm.
And it seems like overkill, doesn't it? I mean, one shot close range is going to be horrific. Mm-hmm. To say multiple, like, close range shotguns, that's, yeah, I can imagine it's very, very brutal, but also it seems, yeah, very personal for him, maybe. I'm kind of sensing that maybe his was overkill.
Especially when you think about, so Dawn and the girls were found together. So there's maybe potential that she was trying to shield the girls, or that positioning of the bodies kind of implied that that might have been the case. So extremely disturbing scene that they walked into. So after the police arrived, the immediate thought is to the three other Pelly children. Quickly, they were all found and they all had alibis of where they were of the morning. So Jessica, who that's Dawn's eldest daughter, she was 9 at the time and she was at a sleepover. Jackie, Bob's daughter, was 14 and was at camp. And Jeff, Bob's son, was 17, celebrating his high school prom that was the night before the bodies were found. And he was at Six Flags Amusement Park several hours away with his girlfriend and friends celebrating their end of year.
Oh, all of that is just horrible. Like, yeah, you're probably at one of your first sleepovers. You're at your prom.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you went away to camp. Yeah. This is what's happening.
But on the flip side, what good luck that three separate events kind of took three of the kids out of the home that morning. Like, you know,
it's true.
One kid being out of home is kind of, you know, expected, but three different things on for three different kids, it's kind of, it's lucky really, but imagine what they went through when they found out.
Yeah. So when the police arrived at the house, they noticed several things pretty instantly that stood out for them. So like I mentioned before, all the doors were locked and the curtains were drawn. So this was raised by a lot of people that knew the Pellys that this was unusual behaviour. They also found several very small drops of blood in the bathroom and also on a hand towel in the bathroom. And they noted that the position of Bob's body that far back in the house and near a bedroom that wasn't accessible from outside might have meant that the killer was either somebody known to the family or was willingly inside the house, is the assumption that the police were starting to make. They noted that there was washing in the washing machine as well. Also, there was a missing shotgun from the wall of the home. So there was kind of like this bracket where a gun would sit. And the missing shotgun was a 20-gauge shotgun that they quickly assumed was the murder weapon. So the lead detective of the case, a guy named Mark Setter, said that it did not look like a burglary and it did not look like a home invasion. So he basically said that, like, the way that the house is like set up and everything's closed down, it looks like, you know, like at the end of the night, you close all your windows and you do all of those things. That was kind of the feel of the house. So they didn't suspect burglary.
I mean, the thing is, if he's a pastor, he's going to be, you would think, I don't know what religion it is, but he's going to be wanting to help people. And even if he had like a stranger come at, you know, the night or whatever, he'd probably be like, yeah, you know, we love everyone here. I don't know. Come in, we'll give you bread. I don't know what happens. Okay. I only know about the manger and the gifts. I don't know the rest. But they seem personable. They seem personable, like they would help strangers.
Yeah, that's good. That's a good point. So as we know, because we follow a lot of cases and a lot of particularly investigations, is that the first actions taken by police are pretty critical, and deciding on what paths to go down generally determines how they interpret some of the evidence. So what we know at the moment is that there's no murder weapon at the house. There was also no shell casings found at the house. There was also no witnesses that heard or saw anything. So all of this made them quickly and squarely look inside the family. So quickly ruling out that murder-suicide thought. Instead, they instantly focused, actually I'd probably use the word almost laser focused, their entire investigation on 17-year-old Jeff Pelly, so the son.
He was at prom, people.
Allegedly.
Being a close-knit town and Bob's role as a reverend, he spent a lot of time with neighbours, friends and parish members. So there really wasn't much to hide, which I think Ben, you called out at the start. And multiple people confirmed that earlier in the week, Bob had made it very clear that Jeff had been grounded and banned from all prom activities, with the exception of the dance itself.
Ooh, but we know he spent an overnight somewhere afterwards, right?
Mm-hmm. Jeff, his girlfriend Darla and their friends had planned several activities around prom. So dinner before the dance, the prom, and then the following day, the trip to Six Flags Amusement Park to celebrate. So Jeff had been grounded by Bob after he was caught stealing CDs from a friend and was in trouble with the police. However, the friend didn't press any charges, and from all accounts, this was pretty much squared away and forgiven as one of those kind of shouldn't have done that kind of situations. So Bob had also told multiple people that himself and Dawn would be driving Jeff to and from the dance, and that he'd actually removed a piece of Jeff's Mustang so that it could not drive as punishment. So this news raised many questions with the police. If Jeff was at Six Flags when his family was found, what had changed? And more importantly, what were his movements prior to the dance the night before?
I am very shocked that no one heard anything.
Mm,
like, if this is a small town and that's a big gun.
Yeah, is the church are there kind of residences around them? Or is it sort of in a bit of an isolated area? Do you know, like?
I think there's probably, like, they're like bigger blocks, but you can see. So like the neighbours, so I'm going to first plug for Counter Clock. The neighbours actually speak a lot about some of the things that they could see from the positioning of their house. And so the houses are clear. So even from that perspective, a gunshot, you would hear that, I think. Yeah. You would assume that you would hear that. So,
I feel like churches are kind of always in the centre of town. Like, they want, you know, they need easy access for elderly people and things. Like, you don't really put them in remote areas. I feel like they're kind of always right smack in the middle. But
I will say that the church is a very, very small church. It's like one of those little cute buildings. So it is a very small church. So the timeline in this case is going to be very important. So it actually is so important that it actually comes down to a matter of minutes. So there's a window, some put it about 10 minutes, some push it roughly to 30 minutes of potentially unaccounted for time that police would argue Jeff, mad at his father for his punishment, would use this time to kill his family with the 20-gauge shotgun, hide the weapon, lock up the house and make it to dinner with his friends. So the day of the murders, the police went and drove to pick up Jeff at Six Flags, and they held him and the girlfriend, Darla, for some time. So after informing them of the murders, they held several interviews during this time. But throughout these discussions with police, Jeff never confessed or admitted anything that would imply any type of guilt. I will praise my main source for the episode throughout this a lot, but the Counter Clock podcast has a very detailed episode on the line of questioning and Jeff's responses at this part. I've summarised here, but there's a lot of detail in there if you're interested in going and really diving deep into that. One of the areas, though, that the police did raise with Jeff was why was he at the events when so many people said he was grounded from doing so? Jeff actually explained that earlier in the week, Bob had said to him if Jeff continued to show good behaviour through the week that he would be allowed to go. The way Jeff tells it, this was not really a big deal and his dad had simply changed his mind. So according to Jackie, so that's Bob's other daughter, According to Jackie, this type of behaviour from Bob was actually not unusual, that her dad was very firm, but he was also fair and would always give the kids an opportunity to redeem himself. So from her perspective, this is not out of character. And also when you listen to Jeff's interview, the way that he describes this, he says it so nonchalantly when he tells his story. It's like, oh, he changed his mind. Like, we made an agreement and I met my side of the agreement, so I was allowed to go.
I believe it.
I mean, it's prom. You're not going to make your son miss prom for stealing a few CDs. I feel like, yeah, you'd maybe use it as kind of leverage to hold it over him for a week or something, make him behave, but you're not going to, I feel like you're going to let him go.
Yeah. And I mean, Jeff's also 17. Like, he's finished school. Yeah. Like, he's essentially an adult. So it's odd that this would be something that he would hold him back from. So yeah, a really good point. So Jeff then explained to police that he, obviously having the piece restored into his car, drove his Mustang, having to briefly stop at the gas station to look at the car because it was running a little bit badly, then went to a friend's house, not too far from where the home was, got changed into his tuxedo, went to dinner, went to prom, and Six Flags the day after. Jeff also accounted for the day of the murders events for all the victims leading up to 4:30 p.m. So the bodies were found on the Sunday. He accounted for all the time on the Saturday prior to that. There are also a number of references where people also can account for seeing himself, Bob, Dawn, and the youngest two girls. So, like I said, this leads us to about 4:30 of the Saturday. So Bob was an amateur photographer, and as the referent, had opened his home up to some of the students to have their prom photos taken by him at the house. So this timeline is a little bit tricky, so you're going to bear with me for a little bit. So students were at the house from roughly 4:30 until 4:50 to 5 o'clock. As there were a number of people who came through the house, there were several conflicting timelines for this period. All agreed, though, that Jeff was at the house wearing blue jeans, not in his tuxedo, as he mentioned he was going to change at his friend's house, between 4:30 and 4:50. This is also the time Jeff claimed to police when he was interviewed that he had left the house. However, the time between 4:50 and 5:30 is disputed. Two students noted that they had visited the house and had forgotten something that they had to drive and leave to go and pick up before going to the dance. And when they passed the house again at 5:15, they said Jeff's Mustang was still at the house. However, friends of Jeff claim that they saw Jeff driving his car at 4:50 to 5 p.m. on a nearby street, so away from the parsonage. Two students who Bob and Dawn were meant to come to their house. So after the students had been at the house, the plan was that at 5:30, Bob and Dawn would go to a particular student's house to take their photos at their house. So when they didn't arrive at 5:30, they got in their car and they drove to the house. So they were there roughly about 5:40 to 5:50 with no answer. They like knocked on all the doors. There was no answer from everybody. And they also said that Jeff's car was gone. Now, this is when it gets a little bit tricky. So students say that Jeff's car was still at the house at 5:15. However, a gas station clerk confirmed that Jeff came to the station at 5:17 to work on his car. He came inside and asked to use the phone to tell his friends he was going to be a little bit late. He then left from inside, worked on his car a little bit more, and then drove off. Jeff then arrived at friends' houses in blue jeans before changing into his tuxedo. So based on the locations of the Pelly home, the gas station and where the friends lived, it's really not possible that Jeff's car could be at the house at 5:15 and at the gas station by 5:17.
I don't think it was the... I feel like it'd be very easy if you've been to the house and you go away and then you come back, not knowing what's going to happen. I think it'd be very easy to confuse which time you saw the car there. Like, did they really see it when they came back the second time, or is their memory kind of just piecing together what they saw the first time?
Yeah, especially when there's nothing, if there's nothing significant happening at that very moment,
exactly.
Even checking the time is something that you wouldn't do. So so the gas station clerk, he very specifically says 5:17, and he talks about how his shift was supposed to end and the person who was supposed to take over didn't arrive on time. So he checked his watch. As he checked his watch, Jeff pulled in. So that was a significant time frame for him.
Yeah.
So he recalled it pretty clearly.
Yeah. Does he say what Jeff's demeanor was like? And was he, did he have blood on him? Did he seem distressed?
That'd be convenient, wouldn't it?
Well, I'm guessing he doesn't, but you know.
He smelled like gunshot residue. Yeah. His blue jeans splattered.
He looked crazed. I mean, he had blood all over him, but we can't be sure.
Really good points, but none of that. So he was understandably a bit frustrated about his car, but when he came in, he said, it's just idling too high, so I've just got to let it, I don't know anything about cars, I've just got to let it do the thing. And that's the same story he tells police when he's first interviewed as well, that the car was idling too high. So that doesn't change. Throughout this case, Jeff's demeanor, it's difficult because he's 17, right? So a 17-year-old boy's demeanor is not always going to be. Yeah, and I think but you know, like if you were told that like this had happened to your family, you just don't know how you would react to that type of news.
Not. Yeah.
But police did call out the fact that he was quite calm as being a red flag, which I think in a lot of cases they do that. If there's kind of like no outward reaction to it, they do kind of call that out a little bit.
Particularly back then, so we're talking 1989, I feel like these days you'd be a bit more, you know, you need to understand that people handle grief and shock differently. Back then it was probably a bit more like guilty.
Yeah, very true.
I will say, and again, 1989, I have to remind myself, but it feels a little bit like he's trying very hard to create a timeline, like going somewhere, being seen at a certain time, making a phone call from there. It seems very much like he's trying to prove that he wasn't home. But then again, this is pre-mobile phones. I have to remember, like, that it was totally normal to go to a place and make a phone call back then. So,
yeah, I don't know. That's a really good theory,
though.
That's my
initial thought, though.
So we've got those conflicting reports. So some are saying that the car was still at the house at 5 o'clock. Others are saying they saw Jeff driving at 5. And Jeff says he left the house around 4:50, 5 o'clock. So we're kind of talking about this kind of like 15-minute window, really, because we also have several people who visited the church. So those students went to the house at 5:40 to 5:50, no answer. And then several people visited the church from 5:50 to 6:30. They saw and heard nothing, and therefore it's assumed that the Pelly family were murdered between 5 o'clock and about 5:20. So this combined with the above really narrows the police time frame down to 10 to 15 minutes for the crimes to be committed.
And what about these kids who came back and said the car wasn't there? Were they ever treated as suspects? Because it seems like they're kind of the last people who were there when they were alive, right? I mean,
so what I will say about this, well, no, so they don't go into the house. They drive past the house at 5:15. They see the car.
So they say, though.
Yeah, very good point.
They were the last people to go back to the house, whether or not they went in.
Yeah, but that's a very good point. And I will say that I said earlier that they lasered in on Jeff, and that's very much what has happened in this case. There was not a lot of exploration of other potential avenues at this time. So with Jeff's timeline and story now known, the police began to paint what those 10 to 15 minutes might have looked like and to search the route that Jeff would have taken to find the murder weapon and the shell casings. But no such luck. The police found nothing. Also, when asked about the family gun, because obviously it's missing from the house, Jackie and Jeff both said that they remember that it being removed from the house at least a year before the murders. But Jessica says that she remembers it being there up on the wall the day before the murders. So once again, the police really only have circumstantial theories at this point that the family gun was the weapon. And despite several searches, the weapon's not found. They never find this weapon.
I'm guessing it's not in the background of any of the prom pics.
No.
Can you imagine?
Look, you got to ask the silly questions, don't you?
No, that's a good point, though. But so police have their theory. They have their theory and they decide to run with this.
I did wonder, what is the point in, if that is the murder weapon and you got it off the wall of the house, what is the point in hiding it? We know the gauge of the shotgun. Anyone could go in there and take the family's gun and use it to shoot. What is the point in taking it away and hiding it if that was the gun that's used? I'm inclined to think maybe the gun wasn't there. Maybe the other kids are right and the one daughter's misremembering it. Because I just don't see why you'd throw the gun away otherwise. Why take it with you?
I tend to agree. And there is those... So the podcast I've already mentioned a few times does go into a bit of more deeper detail about the history with guns in the family. But I tend to agree. I think... No, not in that way, in terms of, like, they did have guns in the house and registered weapons, all that sort of stuff.
Americans.
But it does, yeah. But I'm with you, Ben. I'm inclined to think that the gun was not there of the day. I think it was removed.
And you've got 3 years old. Like, lock it up. Put it on a rack that locks. I mean, maybe it was. I don't know, but I'm guessing it wasn't.
Can they test for gun residue, Olivia Pope style, back in the 80s?
So when they first arrest Jeff, they said that, so when they looked at the gun, because of the type of gun it was, they said that anybody who'd used a gun like that, you would expect to see bruising on, like, from the kickback of the gun. And Jeff was very slender, very small, and he had no bruising on him. They didn't test for gun residue, I don't believe, but he had no bruising or anything, and I don't believe they checked his fingers or anything like that. But that was... checked the bruising and he had nothing, no markings, no nothing. So,
and he's probably been going down water slides at Six Flags. He's probably got chlorines rinsed it all off anyway.
True. Okay, so using the little circumstantial evidence they have, the police piece together Jeff's timeline to include their sequence of the murders, and said that prior to leaving to the house, they claim that Jeff used the washcloths to clean himself up, clean up the blood, noting that there was a couple of, like, a few small drops found, that he put his clothes in the washing machine, including a pair of blue jeans, washed them to remove the blood before leaving for dinner and prom. So it's probably worth thinking about, like, the sequence of all of this, because we're talking, like, 10 to 15 minutes. So their theory is that in 10 to 15 minutes he completed these murder, he had time to clean himself off, he was washing his clothes, that he got the weapon, picked up all the shell casings and was able to hide those things and then make it to their friend's place. The timeline is really, to be able to do that in 15 minutes is a lot. So it's probably...
Let's just talk about the real evidence here. What 17-year-old boy do you know that can use a washing machine? Case dismissed.
It's a very good point, Caroline, because the washing machine becomes a very pivotal point in this story.
No boy is thinking about washing or doing it. Trust me.
So I want to take you back to the crime scene for a minute and what they found there. So the blue jeans that they're saying were found in the washing machine were actually never recorded as being found at the initial crime scene. So no police report or evidence log of the time has blue jeans referenced as part of the clothing removed from the washing machine. This is a really relevant point that we'll return to a little bit later, but I just want to call out that we've referenced blue jeans a few times. I don't know if you've picked up on that as I've been telling the story, but Jeff was wearing blue jeans. So it's just worth calling that out.
And so he was wearing them when he went to the servo? Mm-hmm. Well, how many pairs did he have? Again, 17-year-old boy.
Seems like a rural area, I imagine. I mean, how many pairs, as you say.
This is also relying on a 17-year-old boy bamboozling police by taking shells, whatever, taking guns and hiding them within 10 minutes to a degree that I'm guessing they never found. So how smart is this kid?
You assume he's working alone.
Do you think Darlene's involved? Is that Precious's name, Darlene?
Maybe some mate's kind of done the clean-up stuff while he goes off and he's seen at the petrol station. Maybe someone else is doing, like, a bit of the clean-up and taking the gun away for him.
Okay. Maybe Darla did the washing.
Okay. So with their theory in hand, and the circumstantial evidence, the police felt very strong about Jeff's guilt, despite his continued claims of innocence, and attempted to bring charges against Jeff. However, prosecutors at the time refused to bring charges based on the case made because there just wasn't enough to bring charges against him.
I don't think there's enough to convict him, no.
Yeah, and the police's path, the pathway that they've been taking, finds itself at a complete stop. So this is where things take a pause for over a decade. So for over 10 years, there was not enough in the case to bring charges on Jeff. While lead investigators still firmly believe Jeff committed the crimes, there was only that circumstantial evidence, and their case remained open but cold. So it's worth pointing out that their eyes are on Jeff. There's nothing else in their opinion. It's Jeff. So in that time frame, they don't explore other avenues. They're squarely on Jeff.
And therefore the entire town probably thinks it's him for an entire decade, and he's probably like looked at. Does he stay in town? Yeah. Does he stay in the area?
So he does go off to college for a little while. Okay. Him and Darla do break up, sadly. And he does move back to the town for a couple of years. But exactly what you said, Benny, the tag that he had on him just became too much. So he actually ended up moving back to Fort Myers in Florida, where him and Jackie and Bob and Joy originally lived in Florida. And then we've got like over a decade of life, right? So Jeff continues to live his life. He actually gets married and has a son and builds a really successful career. And things look like they're moving along for Jeff. There's some snags along the way in this time, obviously, especially if you're going through some trauma like this as well. So which are explored in Counterclocks podcast and a couple of other great resources. But I'm just going to skim over that part for this.
Can I quickly ask, just before, because I feel like you're about to say what's changed after 10 years, I just want to get Carrie's point of view on what's your thinking in terms of do you think Jeff did it or not?
No.
Do you have any ideas of who else might have done it?
No, and that's hard.
Do you think the evidence is about to prove that he did or didn't?
I don't think he did it. I feel sick in my stomach for him. I feel like he's going to go down somehow for it. But I just feel like, and again, this sounds horrible, but I just feel like he's a kid. Is he really outsmarting you for a decade? Like, you couldn't put it together. But then I'm like, who else could it have been? Like, we're not seeing any other suspects to really take that.
Mm, yeah, agreed.
To take my mind off him. What do you think?
I feel like it's not going to be him. But I also, as you said, there's no other suspects. I think the police work's obviously shoddy. Like, the fact that they're not itemizing everything they take out of this washing machine is just bonkers. There's a lot of sort of stuff that should be like clearly able to answer and we can't. So I feel like there's a lot of shoddy police work that might let him off if he did do it, but there's definitely not enough to convict him so far.
Because it just makes me think of the West Memphis 3 and like 80s and bad police work in small towns.
Yeah.
And in my heart, I'm just like, well, yeah, what Claire's saying, you've picked a story and now you're looking for evidence that fits that story. You're not looking at evidence that exists.
Yeah, yeah. Confirmation bias and just blocking out anything that doesn't align with your with what you think the answer is. Yeah,
that's the way smart people describe it. Nailed it, Ben.
Right. But you're bang on. So for that decade, lead investigators still convinced that Jeff was the murderer, and that they had enough to try and get him, and they try to elicit confessions a few times, and he just doesn't budge on his innocence. They don't get anything from him. But so we're talking sort of almost 13 years later, there is a change in political representation in town, and the investigators really push for justice for the Pellies. So I will say this about the investigators, like when they speak about this case, they talk so much about wanting justice and peace for the family. And I think West Memphis is a good example, Carrie, of that, like very initial investigation, absolutely shoddy police work in that case. But that kind of quick draw, we just have to find like peace or justice for the family. So they kind of laser in on something back then when they weren't maybe taking their time to go, actually, like, let's really step this out and look at all avenues. So I think I feel like during that time period, there is a few cases that are a bit kind of like lasered in like that. So we've got new political representation, we've got a push for justice and a platform about really solving cold cases, and the Pelley's case is kind of raised as like a platform for that time. And the case was officially reopened with a new investigator. So with fresh eyes on the case and a new prosecutor, they determined that there was, in fact, enough evidence to bring charges against Jeff, and he was officially arrested in 2002 for the murders of Bob, Dawn, Janelle and Jolene.
I am shook. Was there new evidence found? Or this is just based on what they had?
So not necessarily new evidence, but it was people, the new investigators, looking at it maybe from fresh perspectives. I do want to raise what you raised, Benny, about how evidence was handled, because particularly for the blue jeans, they were in like a paper grocery bag. Like they, like the chain of evidence and stuff is, so I'll get to this about the blue jeans a little bit later, but the chain of evidence is a big risk here. And I think... Yeah. Again, like that fight for justice, that platform, that like, you know, we've solved the crime, we finally got charges against him, kind of, that was the push, basically.
Even if he seems the most likely, I'm looking at this like I'm him and I'm thinking, there's no murder weapon that ties me to this. The motive's pretty flimsy. Like, there's not even anyone that can say I was there at that time. Mm, that just doesn't seem like enough.
Yeah.
To go beyond a reasonable doubt.
Mm. One of the things that the lead investigator talks about, so when Jeff did move back to the town after college, that they kind of, I wouldn't call it a relationship, but they did kind of like have, like they would see each other and talk and stuff like that. And one of the things the investigator kind of like, again, about the demeanor is that like he says that Jeff never asked him if they found the killer, never asked about the case, and that to him he's like, that is not the behavior of an innocent man. It kind of, that's what he's implying,
really. I would be like, you're trying to lock me up for this and I know you are, as if I would ever speak to you about it, because anything I say you're going to try and twist into taking me down. Why would I ever ask about it?
And all the time I see examples of the exact opposite, like people who are guilty insert themselves into the crime and want to know what you've got, and they want to know, look, what are the new leads and what are the police thinking, and then we look at them and call them guilty. Yeah. So it's kind of doomed if you do, doomed if you don't.
Yeah, absolutely. And so there was an incident in sort of 1994-ish. So the Pelley murders happened in 1989. But in 1994... Jeff was being investigated by the FBI for medical insurance fraud because he was trying to gain access to his inheritance in Bob and Dawn's, like the trust fund that came out of that. And he'd bogused up all of these like medical bills, and he kind of had like a little syndicate thing kind of going. And the police investigators on this case were like, well, this is our moment. Like maybe we can, the fear of federal indictment might finally get us a confession. But again, he did not budge on it. Those charges, the hospital that was kind of like, the hospital didn't pursue charges on him for that, and he did get a lesser charge of, I think, wire fraud. But he turned his life around from then. He had a really successful job at IBM. Like he was kind of just living his life or whatever. But again, like there's all these kind of things that the police were going, see, like this is dodgy behavior.
Doesn't make you a murderer.
No.
Being weird when you're grieving doesn't make you a murderer.
Yeah.
Trying to get money in a dodgy way doesn't make you a murderer. Like, where's the evidence that he actually murdered somebody? Circumstantial at best. I'm fired up.
So the trial takes place in 2006, and there's a lot of commentary about it, particularly the ability of Jeff's defense team. There's a number of avenues, lines of questioning and sharing of evidence that are just not explored or raised in Jeff's defense. They really don't do much in the trial is probably the best way I could say it. The police argued, and so their argument through the trial, and this is a jury trial, by the way, was that Jeff was furious about the punishment made by Bob, drawing on the confirmation from neighbours that he was banned from doing anything but prom. then Jeff proceeding to attend all the events and citing the clothing found in the washing machine, including a pair of blue jeans, as proof that he had changed out of the murder outfit and attempted to wash the blood to hide his crimes. Okay. So in 2006, Jeff was found guilty of all four murders and sentenced to 160 years in prison.
Where are the jeans? Do they have blood on them? Like, I cannot understand how you could find this person guilty.
So he was convicted only on that circumstantial evidence. So no murder weapon, no shell casings ever found. And Jeff's continued claims of innocence. So 160 years in prison.
Wow, I did not expect 160. That.
160. Someone call the Innocence Project.
Well, it's funny you say that. So since his conviction, Jeff's case was picked up by the Indiana University McKinley Wrongfully Convicted Clinic, and they fought really hard for him since then, even having his conviction briefly overturned in 2008 before it was quickly reinstated. So he's had like a very big mixed bag around this. So his defense team are fighting for a new trial, stating three key areas of focus. So one, that during the trial, key evidence was not shared with them, including Bob's camera and the photos taken on prom night. So some people called it out that why wouldn't Jeff have been in his prom clothes getting photos with his parents? That's unusual. But from other accounts, if you're not super close with your parents or your girlfriend's not there, that might be a bit weird to like just be in your clothes. So those photos and the camera were never shared with the defense team. Number two, there are many questions surrounding the clothes that were allegedly found in the washing machine. So the police claimed during the trial, a pair of blue jeans were the murder outfit found in the washing machine. The defense argue that they cannot be traced back to being found in the washing machine. There's no police records or evidence log stating that that's where they were found. Additionally, a number of witnesses stated that Jeff arrived at his friend's home in blue jeans. And in his initial interview, Jeff stated that before he headed to his house, to his friend's house, so when he was still at home, he changed out of the clothes he'd been wearing during the day and put blue jeans on.
But also, if your whole story is he took off the murder clothes because they had blood on them and had to go clean himself up in the bathroom, where are the jeans with the blood? I would definitely want to be seeing that.
Yeah, well, it's funny. So during the investigations, the jeans were tested for blood and no trace of blood was found on the jeans.
Yeah.
They also did a, I think it's called a litmus test on the washing machine itself to test for blood. And there was no blood found in the washing machine either. In fact, they couldn't even detect detergent. So the defense argues that that might mean that the clothes that were in the washing machine may not have even been washed that day. But again, there's no confirmation that the blue jeans were in the washing machine.
And I'm thinking of like the New Zealand case, like the Bain family murders, you know, the Black Hands case. I remember him throwing like stuff in the washing machine. And the thing is, when clothes are that bloody, one cycle of a washing machine is not going to get it all out. And as you say, if there's no detergent, I mean, there are going to be traces. It's going to be in the jeans and in the drains. You cannot get rid of that much blood with just one cycle of a washing machine.
Like, we've got a big gun, a messy crime scene.
Yeah.
Where is it on him? You haven't proved that.
Yeah. But also the fact that they took, that they're saying that he took the gun and the shell casings, but he washed the bloody clothes in the house. That's odd. Like, if you were going to take those things, you would take the clothes too, surely.
Yeah, you would. And why wouldn't he have hidden them where they're all together? No.
So when thinking about the blue jeans of if they weren't found at the house, then where could they have been found? So it's suggested that they might have actually been taken from the search of Jeff's car that happened the day after the murders. And the grocery, so you know how I said they were found in like a grocery bag, or that's what the evidence looked like. So the mother of the friend that he went to the house to and got changed into his tuxedo, she worked at the grocery store that the bag's from. So it's very plausible that he got changed, she gives him a bag, he puts the clothes in, puts it in his car and goes to Six Flags the next day. So the blue jeans are a very contentious issue in this case.
Like, let's be real. He may have done it and there's no one else in the picture really. But you do not have the evidence, in my opinion, to convict somebody based on what?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm outraged.
I know.
The genes should not be admissible. They should mm-hmm. not be factored in at all. There's just nothing that's crazy.
Mm-hmm. So this part might make it even more fired up. So the third area of focus was Bob's past life in Florida that could potentially provide a different story.
I should have known he had a secret life.
Well, I will say that this is more about a situation that Bob was in rather than his own behaviour. So I will preface it with that first.
Right. I'll be the judge of that.
So during his time living in Fort Myers, Florida, so prior to moving to Lakeville, Indiana, as I mentioned, Bob's job was at a bank. So he was actually running the computer processing component of the entire Landmark Financial Institution network. So this particular network was very well known by police as it had been involved in cocaine trafficking from South America and significant money laundering. It is also said that shady mob-tied people were often also connected to this bank.
So criminals that probably know better than a 17-year-old mm-hmm. boy how to use a gun, hide a gun, clean up stuff they need to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's believed that Bob was aware of the dealings of the bank and wanted to remove himself from that situation, pointing to the hasty move to Indiana as a way to kind of see the thought process that might be there. And then there's also Tony Bueller. So Tony says that, so Tony was from Florida as well. So she says that Bob, prior to leaving Florida, that Bob expressed to her that he was scared that he and his family might be targeted and feared they would be killed. So he told this to her not long before they moved away. Now, this might seem like an odd thing to say, like just out of the blue to someone, but not long before he had this conversation with Tony, Eric Dawson, a high-profiled real estate developer, was murdered execution style. So he was basically like an execution. So Eric did a lot of business through Landmark Bank as well and was said to have been mixed up with some very shady people. Eric's case remains unsolved.
And that's not even to say he's involved, but he obviously knew too much about the process mm-hmm. and what they're doing.
Or he was involved in something. Yep. So Eric's case remains unsolved as well. So it's worth pointing that out as well. Mm-hmm. So when you tie these two things together, they could point to perhaps some scary people looking for Bob or wanting to silence Bob, or maybe for things he'd seen or things that he'd maybe processed. So this is an avenue. So this potential lead was never explored in all the years the case remained open but cold. So during the trial, this was also not raised, leaving many to believe that the police were so focused on Jeff that they failed to explore any other potential options that may explain what happened to the Pellies. And Tony had actually gone to the police following the murders and before the trial with this story and a willingness to testify and was dismissed or not taken seriously, and her story was never explored by police. So there's also the crime itself. So we've already kind of raised this about, I hate using this word, but the sophistication of the case that perhaps seems maybe more likely the work of professionals than a 17-year-old, exactly what you said, Kerry, who had no violent crimes in his history up to this point.
Or after, in the 10 years that he was living life.
Yeah. And, you know, there's no evidence. There's no weapon, there's no casings, and no DNA that they could find or that they've mentioned. And so really meticulous planning, really.
Kill his little sisters, two of them but not one? Why would he do it when they're not all there? He would either want to take out all of them to make, you know what I mean? Or, it just doesn't make sense to me.
But it's around the heat, the emotion around the prom, right? So it's kind of that's the event that's triggered it that night, I suppose. So maybe if it was him, and I don't think it was, he's kind of acting out of emotion based on what's happening that night, and some of the siblings just aren't there.
But if you're snapping in an angry emotion, you're not then calm enough to than go fiddle with your car at the gas station.
Mm. Well, the police's kind of theory was that Bob was the target, that he was mad at Bob, and that Dawn and the girls just were in the house. That's the police's theory, that they were kind of like collateral damage, if you will. But even that, if you think about the sophistication of the crime scene, like in terms of like not leaving the evidence behind, if you weren't maybe planning for them to be there, or it was a heat of the moment decision to take the gun off the wall and do what he did, there's like a 10-15 minute window. Like that's not a lot of time to kind of make those decisions potentially. Okay, so the Counterclock podcast does explore a number of additional witnesses who either saw something or highlighted things that maybe the police either dismissed or just didn't navigate further, that maybe not have led to anything, but there were potential kind of like little points that they probably could have gone and at least investigated and then dismissed, but they didn't do a lot of those types of things. And there's a lot that kind of I haven't been able to explore in this story from that perspective. So I think it's important to talk about the impacts that this crime has had, obviously, on the two remaining sisters and their roles in the case now. So Jackie, Jeff's biological sister and Bob's daughter, has been very vocal of her support and advocacy for Jeff and remains steady in her position that Jeff has been wrongfully convicted and still fights for his freedom through her website, justiceforjeff.org. But for me, one of the most heartbreaking aspects of this story is of Jessica, who was just 9 when this crime took place and obviously really struggled with the loss of her family. She was kind of shuffled to her grandparents and then ended up in foster care because of using behavioural issues to kind of cope with her trauma. She's spoken openly about the devastating impacts the loss of her family have, but perhaps worse still is that she was not aware that Jeff was a suspect until he was arrested. She had believed that Bob had killed her family and then killed himself. She had also reconnected with Jeff sort of in her mid-teens, but it wasn't until Jeff had been formally arrested that Jessica began to piece the story together that she'd been told and the version police were leading with that made her make the decision to work with police against Jeff. She's spoken about Jeff's behaviour growing up, that she said he was mean to her and things like that. And she firmly believes that Jeff is guilty and she still fights to keep Jeff in prison now. There's a really good interview with her as well where she talks about that, but also she details her story in her memoir, I Am Jessica, and has been able to find some peace and build a family and has a good job and things like that now. So overall, there is not a lot of happiness at the end of this story. There are still many who sit on either side of the fence of this. Many believe that the evidence against Jeff may appear weak, but he is guilty, while others point to the fixation by police on Jeff that stopped the exploration of other avenues such as Bob's past, the people he might have been associated with, and the sophistication of the crime that potentially was a professional hit. So as of 2024, as of today, Jeff is still waiting for decision on whether or not he will be granted a fresh trial. The defence believe they have a strong argument and the additional avenues we've explored in this episode need to be examined and considered by the courts. As for Jeff, as he has done for the past 35 years, remains strong on his claims of innocence that he did not commit this crime.
Wow. I know it's very easy to say, like, because in my mind, I'm thinking about Jessica. Of course, you should want this trial too. Like, if you really believe he did it, then what's the difference to you? Like, the evidence will show that. But then, obviously, this person is going through hell listening to the case again. And I can't imagine what that would be like. And we can't take away her experience of what she's been through. But, you know, the law should be the law and there's just not enough evidence. Mm-hmm. Even if he did it, there is not enough evidence for me.
I think without a confession, there's not a lot from what they
murder
have.
Murder weapon.
There's not
any physical evidence at all.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm.
Like, you can't prove he was actually there. You can't prove he's connected to any weapon that committed the crime. I mean, what else can we say?
Yeah, even the window of time that, like, there's conflicting thoughts on, like we were saying before about, did they see the car there at 5:15, or maybe it was 5 o'clock? All those kinds of things that, like, that in itself makes it really tricky to, like, piece together that very, very short window of time. And nobody heard anything. No one heard anything.
Which also says to me, professional, I don't think the gun was in the house. That's my call. I don't think the gun was on the wall. I think that did go a year ago. I think a professional did this.
I was sort of thinking, like, I know we kept on saying professional, but, and maybe this is just me jaded because I listened to so many crime stories, but to me, professional sort of is like one shot. I mean, yeah, there are behaviours like separating the mum and children, like that would suggest a professional killing. But if you are just a person who doesn't live there and you come into the house and it's about shoot, you take the casings, like I feel like that's kind of a very basic known thing now, like you take the shell casings. I don't know that a lot else points to it being a real professional killing other than the fact that they didn't get cut themselves or injure themselves and leave DNA in the process, which is kind of
but
just dumb luck, really.
They've silenced it somehow. They've silenced the gunshot somehow because no one's heard it. Like, how would have he known how to do that? Would he have learnt that at high school? Like,
we don't know that it was silenced necessarily. I'd like to see how close neighbours are and what else was going on at that time of day. Is there loud traffic around that area? I don't know. I'd kind of like to know more about that. Because you can silence a shotgun, can't you? Can you silence a shotgun?
I'd put a pillow in front of it like they do in the movies, but
I think you can silence them, but I don't know if you could back in 1989, to be honest. I think there's modern silencers, but back then I don't know if you could silence a shotgun anyway.
Yeah.
I'm saying this so confidently and masculine, but I have no idea if I'm right.
I believe it.
Yeah, it sounds
believable. Yeah, it does sound very believable. Yeah, absolutely.
I have just one question that my opinion is hinging on his guilt. Do you know, and you probably won't, but do you know when they moved to this town, when he said, right, I'm going to change my life and follow God and I'm going to move to this town, was that something that was kind of well known? Was it something that he did quietly as if to kind of go into hiding? Did he sneak away, or was it sort of very well known that he was going there? Because that would sort of give a strong indication. Was he running from danger?
That's a really good question. I don't necessarily know the answer to that. He did openly tell his pastor, and so I would make an assumption that he probably at least told a few other church members maybe about it. But that's a really good question. I actually don't know. I don't know the answer to that. But he did willingly tell the pastor about it.
But that's also someone who legally has to keep his secrets, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he was very lippy in this podcast when he talked about it. So in the Counterclock series, they do speak to him. So he volunteers his info quite readily. So,
but that's posthumously, right? Like, as in back when he moved before he died, something that was kind of a well kept secret? Maybe he was telling someone trusted in the community that he knew wouldn't spread it. I'd really like to know. Was he? That would kind of give me an idea if he was really hiding from danger. Because initially he had the trauma and he saw the light and that's totally normal. And, you know, you kind of look for spirituality, but yeah, looking at it more now.
That's a really good point. Yeah.
Yeah, like I want to know if he told anyone at the bank.
Yeah, exactly, the bank. Really did they know where he went? Did he tell any of his old friends where he went?
Yeah.
How easy was he to track?
But they also didn't change their names. Like, he could have gone by like Reverend Robert if he was in hiding, maybe. Like, they didn't change their name. So that's a really good point. I'm not sure.
But it is pre-internet. I feel like you may not have needed to change your name, but you probably could move towns and maybe get away with it if you didn't tell anyone where you're going. But if he told everyone at the bank, then obviously you weren't that scared.
And did you say they moved in 85 and this happened in 89? Is that right?
86. They moved.
They moved in 86 and it happened in 89. Mm-hmm. So maybe it took 3 years to track them down.
Mm-hmm.
True. Mm. Yeah. As I said, and I'm come back for part two because because I'm so keen for both of you to go and listen to the really in-depth investigation about this, because there's a lot of elements of this that I've had to cut out or remove that I think are avenues that would be really interesting for you both for some of the questions that you're asking.
Okay. What do you think as someone who has listened to all the 20 million episodes?
I've listened to it quite a few times and I've read a lot about this case and I don't think Jeff did it. I really don't. I think that I do believe his storyline. I think that he did arrive in the blue jeans. I don't think that he had the level of meticulous planning to commit the crime. I think also the relationship between him and Bob, from the things that I've seen, there was, a little bit of tension. You're a teenage boy, the only boy in a very small house as well. And from some of the things that Jackie had said is that Bob was pretty insistent on them calling Dawn mum, and they had no issue with the marriage. They had no problem with that. But I think there might have been some tension between him and Bob, but I just don't think that's enough to do this type of crime. I just don't think there is.
Now, when you're that age and you're about to move out anyway, you're literally like, you know.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah. Minutes away from freedom.
Yeah, minutes away from freedom. Why would you? It seems silly to react at that point in time.
And he was letting him go to the prom, wasn't he? Just not the other events.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, like, that's even, like, pretty reasonable. Like,
what I would be really. Wild. The part for me that I have a lot of questions about is that the students that were at the house before.
Yeah.
Because I'm not sure how, like, obviously, like, the adults knew. Bob had gone and spoken to, like, the neighbours and friends and stuff. But did other students know that he was, like, banned from these things? Darla did, obviously. And he does talk about in his initial police interview that when Bob had told him, earlier in the week that if he showed good behaviour that he might be able to go, he did call Darla the Friday night to say, I'm pretty sure I'm going to be able to go. So, like, make sure the reservations are done and da 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 da. But I'd be curious to know if the students that were at the house, if at any point one of them was like, I thought you weren't allowed to go to that. Yeah. Or I thought your dad was going to drive you to that. From what I've seen, I haven't seen anybody kind of question that. But that could
also
be. That
seems like a very reasonable parenting thing to be like, hey, look, this is what it is right now, but if you can prove to me, over these next couple of weeks that you can do the right thing by doing these things, we'll talk about it. Like, that's
and you know
not
full
crazy.
Well the whole time you're going to let them go.
Yeah, 100%.
You're just using it for leverage. Yeah.
You didn't even think you could stop him in the first place.
That was such a good representation of mum.
Yeah, you've got the mum voice down pat, Gary.
Yeah, you really do. It's so good.
I practice it. Every 20 seconds.
So that brings us to the end of my case.
Well done. That was so good. And it was a fresh case, which I'm thrilled about. It's given me, I actually do want to go listen to the whole thing now. Even though I think you've kind of chosen the key points that we really need to know, I know that kind of I would like to see some of the other leads that they explored and things like that. And mm-hmm. How, yeah. The more formal interviews that he gave to sort of understand his wording and things like that. But
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Good case choice. Really well presented.
Fascinating. Really fascinating.
Yeah.
I'm glad that you are invested in it as well. And hopefully, I think all three, so for Jeff, Jessica and Jackie, I think hopefully they get some answers either way on whether or not Jeff will get a new trial. Hopefully that happens soon. They've been waiting for a while for that outcome. It's been kind of on that waiting period for quite a long time. There are many elements of the case I haven't been able to explore deeply here, and I really do encourage everybody to go and listen to Counterclock, because their investigation for this podcast was over a year of investigation, and there's a lot of avenues and there's a lot of episodes about the post-trial period where they have been exploring the evidence that was there, really starting to try and piece together things like the process of the blue jeans, where that could have come from, and some additional elements around Bob's past, also Eric Dawson. There's a bit more information about some possible further connections that place the Pelly families closer together with that potential syndicate. I would really recommend doing that. I also used a number of other sources for tonight, but I'll also call out High Time Crime episode Prom Night Murders, available on YouTube, and also Crime Junkie podcast has an episode called The Prom Night Murders as well that covers this case as well. Edit that for a second.